The headlines: Europe's largest economy, Germany, slashes its growth forecast for this year due to a second coronavirus lockdown. Iran's president says the world agrees that the U.S. should make good on its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. Also in the headlines, India steps up security in the capital, New Delhi, after protests against the government's agricultural reforms turned violent on Tuesday. Thanks for joining us. Europe's economic powerhouse, Germany, has slashed its growth forecast for 2021 to 3% as it continues to reel from the coronavirus pandemic. The projection is a significant revision from last autumn's growth estimate of 4.4%. The economy minister, Peter Altmaier, cited infections and a second coronavirus lockdown as reasons for the revision. He also cautioned that the situation remains serious due to a new, more transmissible COVID variant. Altmaier added that although German industries are doing well, the service sector is suffering due to restrictions. Last week, Germany extended its lockdown until mid-February amid a steep rise in daily cases and fatalities. The country has so far logged over 2.1 million infections and some 54,000 deaths. The European Union says it has asked British-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca to publish its contract for COVID vaccines amid an escalating row over delivery delays. An EU official said the details revealed by the company's CEO on the contract on Tuesday were confidential. The official was referring to remarks by Pascal Soria, who said that the agreement with Brussels was based on a best effort clause. That means that AstraZeneca is not bound to a specific timetable for vaccine deliveries. Soria also defended his company's rollout efforts. Pharmaceutical firm and the EU are set to meet today to discuss delays. The EU has threatened legal action against the firm. The bloc has already ordered 100 million doses for the first quarter this year. Jerome Hughes says that the transparency regarding the COVID vaccine rollout has been a long-standing concern among EU members.
It's one of the big points in all of this all along was the issue of transparency, and we had EU lawmakers and so on accusing the European Commission of showing a lack of transparency in terms of its dealings with the pharmaceutical companies. And now we have a situation where the European Commission is accusing the pharmaceutical companies of showing a lack of transparency. And it appears that all along perhaps it wasn't the European Commission showing a lack of transparency, because the pharmaceutical companies are not willing to say where they've sent vaccines to, how many doses they've sent to, and so on. And the reason the European Commission is asking these questions is because, as you mentioned, you know, they're supposed to get from AstraZeneca, just one example, supposed to get 100 million doses before the end of March. It now seems that the AstraZeneca will deliver 30 million doses. So that's a big reduction in the number that was promised. The European Commission says this is breach of contract. And as you mentioned, this best effort clause, AstraZeneca is saying that, you know, this is a best effort clause. It means that it's not written in stone that it has to deliver the 100 million doses. The European Commission is saying this is a term that's used in all contracts when a product is still in development. So now the European Commission wants full transparency from AstraZeneca.
Group of rights groups and NGOs has threatened France with legal actions over racial profiling by the country's police against people of color and ethnic minorities. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other groups have warned they will file a class action lawsuit. They have given the French government 4 months to act to end what they called systemic discrimination by police or face legal action. In a 350-page warning letter, the group also called for a change in France's criminal code to explicitly ban discrimination during identity checks. The move comes amid mounting allegations of police racism, especially toward immigrants and people of color. In December, President Emmanuel Macron himself acknowledged about the problem of discrimination against the people of African or Arab descent in France. Humanity faces a climate emergency. That's what nearly two-thirds of 1.2 million people polled by the UN across the world are saying. The poll was conducted in 50 countries, hosting more than half of the world's population. Concerns were mostly high in Britain, Italy, and in Japan, with some 80% calling climate change a global emergency. In those countries, climate change has visibly increased heat waves, drought, and flood-inducing rainfall. The UN says there is now broad support for urgent climate action across nationalities, age groups, and education levels. says that people want their policymakers to tackle the crisis, mainly by protecting forests and natural habitats. The Iranian president says the world agrees that the U.S. should make good on its commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
All countries are of the opinion that the United States should return to its obligations. There is a consensus on that across the globe. The whole world is unanimously telling the U.S. to return to its commitments as soon as possible.
President Rouhani said Tehran scaled down its commitments under the nuclear deal because the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of it and Europe failed to fulfill its obligations. He said that Iran will immediately return to all of its commitments as soon as other signatories do so. The Iranian president also noted that not only has the U.S. economic war on Iran failed, but its days are numbered as well. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump launched a maximum pressure campaign on Iran in 2018. The campaign has led to harsh sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Iran and Russia have called for the preservation of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, saying that it is up to the U.S. to take the first steps by removing the sanctions if it is sincere in its assertion that it wants to go back to the nuclear deal. Marina Kortanova has more from Moscow.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then, of course, the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev. Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has hailed the extension of the New START nuclear arms control treaty with the U.S. Addressing the Davos virtual summit, Putin said the deal is, quote, a step in the right direction, reducing global tensions. Earlier, Russian lawmakers voted in favor of extending the treaty by 5 years. On Tuesday, Putin and his U.S. counterpart held the first phone call since Joe Biden took office a week ago. They agreed that the teams work urgently to complete the extension before the new START treaty expires next week. Two countries had failed to reach such agreement under former U.S. President Donald Trump. Moscow and Washington signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty in 2010. It limits the number of nuclear warheads deployed by them to 1,550 each. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the latest agreements by the U.S. and Russia to extend the nukes control treaty could benefit all.
I'm certainly hopeful that the return to some kind of an agreement would be beneficial, not just for the United States, but for the rest of the world. I mean, the further proliferation of missiles and nuclear, particularly nuclear missiles, is not really good for the cause of world peace. What we're talking about is two very powerful countries that already possess the capability of defending themselves. Both countries have weapons that are capable of destroying the entire world several times over. The proliferation of any more weapons by these two is completely unnecessary. It's not needed. However, if the threat of such a thing happening does happen, then everybody else has to follow suit. If, the old saying that if somebody builds a bomb and somebody else has to build a bomb and then somebody else builds a bigger bomb, they have to match it. If there can be some kind of an agreement to stop at some point, some rational point, then we have basically a position where the weapons are not escalating. And this signifies something very important because there are far better things that money could be spent on.
India has beefed up security in the capital, New Delhi, after protests against the government's agricultural reforms turned violent on Tuesday. Police have blocked several main roads around New Delhi and have set up barricades. Riot police have also been put on high alert in the city, one day after angry farmers held a tractor rally on Republic Day. There were chaotic scenes in the capital after the protesters and police engaged in pitch battles, leaving one person dead and hundreds injured. Farmers have been protesting against new agricultural laws over the past 3 months. Several rounds of talks have failed to make a breakthrough. The government claims the reforms will boost rural incomes, but the farmers insist the legislation will destroy their bargaining power and will leave them at the mercy of big corporations. Israel has intensified its anti-Iran rhetoric, claiming the regime is preparing new operational plans against the Islamic Republic. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
On this edition of the News Review, an Israeli general claims the regime is refreshing its operational plans against Iran, saying the U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear agreement would be wrong.
Recently, we have seen, with the change of the administration in the U.S., the Iranians have already announced that they want to return to the previous agreement. I would like to state my position, a position I share with all my counterparts when I meet them across the globe. A return to the 2015 nuclear agreement, or even if it's a similar accord with several improvements, is bad and wrong from an operational and strategic point of view.
Aviv Kochavi added that Iran's scaling back of its commitments under the 2015 nuclear accord show Tehran could be planning to build nuclear weapons. Kochavi stated that he has instructed the regime's forces to prepare a number of operational plans in addition to those already in place. The remarks come as the new U.S. administration mulls over returning to the JCPOA, which Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from in 2018. Tel Aviv was frequently threatened strikes against the Islamic Republic over its nuclear program. Tehran has also on several occasions reiterated that it will respond swiftly to any acts of aggression against the country. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mr. Scott Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign joining us from Edinburgh. Also, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maarouf joining us from Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Napier. Let's jump right in. Give us your perspective on the recent claims by the Israeli regime.
Well, the threats from Hanegbi are rather vague. He talks about changing operational plans, but nothing in detail. And we should remember that over the last 5-6 years, the Israelis have alternated between threatening that they would attack Iran, but quite often moving from that to saying it's important for the USA to attack Iran because Israel couldn't quite do it. So the threats remain vague. They're real and should be taken very seriously. Remember that the same year as the joint agreement with Iran was signed, 2015, Netanyahu thanked Secretary of State John Kerry for blocking a conference on a nuclear-free Middle East, a conference that was supported by every other country in the region and many outside it, and was opposed only by the USA, Israel, of course, and my own government, the UK. That determination to avoid a nuclear-free Middle East was reiterated last year at the UN conference, I think late 2019, where every country again was present except Israel. So it's very serious because the Israelis are determined to use their nuclear weapons to leverage their power throughout the region. The New York Times ran a story that in 1967 the Israelis were threatening to detonate a nuclear weapon in Egyptian Sinai if the war had gone against them. It didn't. But again, they also threatened a nuclear weapon, according to UPI and according to senior U.S. diplomats who told the news agency, they also threatened a nuclear weapon on Cairo in 1973 when that war was going badly for a period of time against Israel. So the Israelis have used these threats in the past. They are determined that they will maintain a nuclear monopoly in all serious matters across the Middle East. And it's quite possible that they might try to mount an attack on Iran. But in order to do that, they will need the cooperation of either Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Jordan, which would pose serious threats for those governments in terms of their own public opinion. So Israel's determined to destabilize the situation. It's determined to ramp up stress and tension throughout the region. Whether it can actually carry out these threats is quite another matter.
Leith Maruf, your thoughts on the issue. Do you agree with Mr. Napier as the Israelis are, in fact, after destabilization?
Definitely they're after destabilization, but we have to be very clear that apartheid Israel doesn't have the capability to attack Iran's nuclear sites. And if it did, it would have attacked them a decade ago, not yesterday, not the day before. And just like they did attack the Iraqi nuclear reactor as it was built, the supposed Syrian nuclear reactor that was being built before the beginning of the 2000s. So in reality, apartheid Israel needs the American military to attack Iran because it does not have the capability to do so. We saw the threats of the B-52s flying multiple times on the borders of Iran before Trump left office. And that's the only thing that they can use to actually attack Iran if they want to, which means that the United States, if it actually does not join a war, even with the vessels of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, or Jordan joining apartheid Israel in a war with Iran, they will be decimated. And they know that. And so we have just the Zionists barking right now in fear of the American retreat from the region. Although Biden is increasing the military forces, American occupation forces in Iraq and Syria, they will be leaving eventually because they have reached a dead end to how much the United States can project power. And to be very frank, if the United States or apartheid Israel attacks Iranian nuclear sites, even without using a nuclear weapon in that attack, the effects would be equivalent to a nuclear detonation. The whole region will be living a nuclear fallout from those attacks, and their response from not only Iran, but the whole world would be eternal condemnation for apartheid Israel and its Jewish supremacist ideology that birthed it.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to Mr. McNapier joining us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to Leith Maruf speaking to us from the Lebanese capital.
And that is World News. That's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Evidence that a variant of the coronavirus identified in South Africa might compromise immunity sparks concerns about vaccine effectiveness, says Evan Calloway, researcher, in an article published under the heading, Fast-spreading COVID variant can elude immune responses. Stay tuned for the details, please. Evidence is growing that some coronavirus variants could evade immune responses triggered by vaccines and previous infections. Researchers are trying to make sense of a tsunami of lab studies released recently that raise concerns about some emerging variants and mutations. Some of the data I've seen in the last 48 hours have really scared me, says Daniel Altman, an immunologist at Imperial College London, who worries that some of the results could portend a reduction in the effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines. But the picture is murky, Altman and other scientists emphasize. The studies, which examined the blood of a small numbers of people who had recovered from COVID-19 or received a vaccine, probed only their antibodies' capacity to neutralize variants in lab tests, and not the wider effects of other components of their immune response. Neither do the studies indicate whether the changes in antibody activity make any difference to the real-world effectiveness of vaccines or the likelihood of reinfection. Are these changes going to be important? I really don't know, says Paul Business, a virologist at Rockefeller University in New York City, who co-led one of the studies. Much of the concern centers around a variant that researchers identified in South Africa in late 2020. A team led by Tulio do Oliveira, a bioinformatician at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa, linked the variant called 501Y.V2 to a fast-growing epidemic in Eastern Cape Province that has since spread across South Africa and into other countries. The lineage carries many mutations in the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, the immune system's prime target, which allows the virus to identify and infect host cells, including some changes linked to weakened antibody activity against the virus. The Eastern Cape was hit hard by South Africa's first COVID-19 wave, and researchers wondered whether the rapid spread of 501Y.V2 could be partly explained by its ability to elude previously established immune responses. To investigate this, Do Oliveira, virologist Alex Sigal at the Africa Health Research Institute in Durban, and other colleagues
isolated 501 Y.V2 viruses from people infected with the variant. They then tested the variant samples against serum. The antibody-containing portion of blood taken from 6 people who had recovered from COVID-19 caused by other versions of the virus. This convalescent serum tends to contain neutralizing or virus-blocking antibodies that can prevent infection. The researchers found that the convalescent serum was much worse at neutralizing 501Y.V2 than at neutralizing variants that circulated earlier in the pandemic. Some people's plasma performed better against 501Y.V2 than did others, but in all cases, the neutralizing power was substantially weakened. It's extremely worrying. In a separate study, a team led by virologist Penny Moore at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases and the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, probed the effects of convalescent serum on various combinations of spike mutations found in 501Y.V2. They did this using a pseudovirus, a modified form of HIV that infects cells using the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. These experiments showed that 501Y.V2 contains mutations that blunt the effects of neutralizing antibodies that recognize two key regions of a spike, its receptor binding and N-terminal domains. Pseudoviruses with the full package of 501Y.V2 mutations were fully resistant to convalescent serum from 21 out of 44 participants and were partly resistant to the vast majority of people's sera, Moore's team found. There is now proof of several reinfections with 501Y.V2 in South Africa, says Do Oliveira. It seems increasingly likely that the variant's ability to spread in places hit hard by earlier waves of COVID-19 is being driven, in part, by its capacity to evade immune responses that developed in response to earlier versions of the virus. It becomes virtually inescapable that that's what's happening, says Benzes, noting that variants identified in Brazil and the United Kingdom carry some of the same spike mutations. Both South African teams will soon test the 501Y.V2 variant with serum from people who participated in COVID-19 vaccine trials. And similar studies are underway at labs worldwide. A team co-led by Benzes found that mutations in the receptor binding domain of 501Y.V2 caused a modest drop in the potency of antibodies from people who had received either vaccines of Pfizer or Moderna. That's a reassuring finding, says Moore, but it will be important to test the consequences of other mutations in 501Y.V2. Whether these could lessen the effectiveness of vaccines is still uncertain, says Volker Thiel, an RNA virologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. Most COVID-19 vaccines elicit high levels of antibodies that target diverse regions of the spike protein. So, some of the molecules are likely to be able to block variants of the virus. And other components of the immune response, such as T cells, might not be affected by 501Y.V2. Although the vaccines target only the spike gene, they should still mount an immune response that is diverse enough that these new variants should be covered, Thiel says. What experimental studies need to be done? Data from ongoing efficacy trials and national vaccine rollouts should be able to uncover the effects of the variants. Several vaccines are still being trialed in South Africa, and researchers will be watching for any drop in their ability to prevent COVID-19 that's linked to the rise of 501Y.V2. A dampened antibody response to variants such as 501Y.V2 might not be much of a problem in practice, says Marian Koopmans, a virologist at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. You can see some change in a lab assay, which does not have an effect in a person because that person still has enough antibodies to neutralize the infection. It can also be difficult to disentangle whether reinfections are due to waning immune responses triggered by the first infection or to the effects of a mutation, she adds. Clues are also beginning to emerge about the behavior of a fast-spreading variant identified in the United Kingdom known as B117. In pseudovirus experiments, researchers at biotech firm BioNTech in Mainz, Germany found that B117's spike mutations had little effect on sera from 16 people who had received the vaccine. Meanwhile, a team led by virologist Ravindra Gupta at the University of Cambridge, UK, looked at the sera of 15 people who had received the first of two doses of the same immunization. The team found that 10 people's sera was less effective against B117 than against other versions of SARS-CoV-2. These changes shouldn't make a difference to the vaccine's effectiveness now, says Gupta, but they could as antibody levels wane over time. What this week's results mean for battling the pandemic are not yet clear. It is a top priority for researchers to determine whether mutations in 501Y.V2 are responsible for reinfections. If they are, says Do Oliveira, the whole idea of herd immunity would become a pipe dream, at least from natural infection.
Inside Israel. About half of secular Israelis, 48%, are unwilling to live alongside Haredim or ultra-Orthodox Jews. That's according to a poll conducted by the Aluma Equality Advocacy Group and the ERI Research Institute in Israel. According to the poll, 69% of secular Israelis said they would rather have Arab neighbors than Haredi ones. This, as another 62% said they would rather live next to Bedouins, who are also Palestinian descendants, than with the ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Well, the situation is not very exciting. It's not very... we didn't choose it, but it happened. I mean, quite a few times in the year, in every year, all the time there is, you know, opportunities when the secular and the non-secular have, you know, very complicated discussions between each other. And with the corona, we've seen it so many times, and I hope it's going to go down, but it looks that, you know, that there is a big wall between the secular people and the non-secular people.
This is a record high of hostility towards the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. According to the author of the study, Dr. Gali Sambira, there's no doubt that the greatest tension exists between the ultra-Orthodox and secular Israelis. The secular Israelis who identify themselves as liberals are only liberal towards the sectors that are convenient for them, the study noted. For example, they are liberal towards Arabs, but not towards the ultra-Orthodox Jews. This while traditional Israelis are liberal towards religious Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox. Each group considers itself to be liberal. Apparently, the coronavirus pandemic also increased the polarization. 74% of Haredim reported that the situation has become worse towards them. They feel it in real life as well. One respondent to the survey said, "If I cough on the bus, I feel like a hired assassin. If a Haredi gets on the bus, he immediately feels like an enemy to the people." The results of the poll showed the evident polarization between different sectors in Israel. Among the different groups in Israel, the greatest tension exists between the ultra-Orthodox and secular Israelis. Secularism is the point of contention between Zionists and the ultra-Orthodox community inside and outside of Israel. Many in Israel, and of course across the world, wrongly believe that Zionism is a part of Judaism, or is compatible with Judaism, or is even the main part of Judaism. All of those are actually false, according to ultra-Orthodox Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. Zionism was created to negate Judaism. Zionism was created to replace Judaism. The differences between Judaism and Zionism are vast and profound. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Shira on Twitter says, "I guess I've always thought I was very familiar with those rifts. Like, I thought the main Orthodox secular rift was between the Haredim and secular Israelis. But I didn't realize how much animosity there was between secular Israelis and the group I most identify with, Dati Leumi." Genesis says, "They are very secular though, and this often puts them at odds with other right-wing parties because they think the Hasidic Haredim should do their military service just like other Israelis." Gil says, "Israeli society has an aggressive counter-push to it between Haredim and secular authorities. I've only seen it up close a few times, but it's scary on both sides."
Each time that there is a trial, that he must stand for a trial, he's not coming, or he's making a closer for Israel or something. And we are really mad at him.
Okay, well, the question here is what the definition of Judaism and Jews is. Basically, Judaism is a religion, a pure religion, the service of Almighty God, the practice of the commandments of the Torah, the Jewish requirements, versus the new nationalistic political movement, Zionism, which drops everything holy and everything attached to God. One of the basics of Judaism is a concept that Jewish people are in exile. For 2,000 years, we are forbidden to fight other nations. Then we have this new movement, which fights for their nationalism and for their country. These people, from the very beginning, are embarrassed by traditional Judaism. They didn't want to see this continuing. They don't want to see this in their way. But still in all, we are here. Our communities are strong. We are loyal to God. We don't fight our neighbors. We practice our religion. And this is unappreciated by them. From the very beginning, they attempted and they did all in their ability to uproot Judaism, the belief in God, from the masses of the Jewish people. Aside of their movement, who were people that unfortunately left Judaism for a long time, they attempted to uproot Judaism from the remaining communities in the Holy Land, or those who immigrated to the Holy Land. They did everything they could to impose their lifestyle and their beliefs and their approach upon everyone. They hoped that Jewish tradition would no longer continue, but thank God they were unsuccessful. They are unsuccessful. Well, unfortunately, the mainstream media in Israel, as in so many other parts of the world, are on the other side, are on the side of the secular people in Israel. Unfortunately, they don't respect the community that lived in the Holy Land way before Zionism and this new movement came up to the Holy Land. They don't respect the serious communities in the Holy Land, the serious leadership of our communities, and you know, all these communities are totally disregarded, not respected, and basically oppressed.
Much of the ultra-Orthodox community considers itself anti-Zionist. Much of the friction between the secular community and the ultra-Orthodox community revolves around the definition of Judaism and what Zionism means for both groups. The propaganda that Zionists have churned out for the past 100 years have confused and conflicted Zionism and Judaism. The average person thinks that Israel is the Jewish so-called state and that Zionism is Judaism and wouldn't know the difference. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political and it is also national. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is completely religious. Thus, a Jew by definition is somebody who accepted the Jewish religion or somebody that is defined by the Jewish religion as a Jew. According to Zionism, however, Jewish identity is political and it is defined the same way that would define any nationalist like a Canadian or a Frenchman. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is centered around a nation state which they randomly decided is the nation-state that was incepted in 1948 onto Palestinian lands that they call Israel. So you can see that the differences are immense, and the friction has been there since the inception of Palestinian lands in 1948 and has only grown far apart. The latest poll by the Aluma Equality Advocacy Group and the ERI Research Institute in Israel on the tension between secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community only confirms this schism. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Baruch on Twitter says, the same way the Israeli left and secular parties uses Haredim as a boogeyman to galvanize their electorate, they use the settlers. We have huge budgets. We upset the Arabs and the world. We're fanatics. What type of kippah do secular Israeli politicians wear when they're at a religious ceremony or place? I've noticed that often left-wing politicians use knitted kippahs, customary among the religious Zionists, and right-wing politicians put black kippahs, like the ultra-Orthodox Haredim. Brian says, you must admit that it's a similar thing going on in secular Israeli minds when Haredim start moving into their neighborhoods, and they begin to worry that the Haredim will start demanding that shops close on Shabbat, no driving on the street, etc.
It was certainly not done for the peaceful, religious, God-fearing community that lived in the Holy Land way before this movement came. This was not done for refugees from the Holocaust, who are seriously religious people and very strongly opposed the movement of Zionism even before the Holocaust. This was done for the people who dropped Judaism for a long time and insisted that they want to have a sovereign homeland for themselves, which happens to be in total contrast to Judaism and Jewish tradition. And they forced so many people to go along with their philosophy. Unfortunately, so many refugees from the Holocaust that didn't have any other choice, and they were like almost forced to immigrate to the Holy Land. This was not in favor of so many people. So many people who could have had so many other alternatives, and unfortunately they were forced to the Holy Land against their will. Now, to make this very clear, this is not in favor of the Jewish people as a whole. This is not in favor of God or God's religion. This is in favor of a community of people who decided to drop God and drop Jewish religion and do their political movement on the account of so many people, Jewish and non-Jewish alike. Okay, religious Jews follow God, believe in God, believe in the basics of Jewish belief, practice the Jewish religion, the commandments, 613 commandments of the Holy Torah. One of the basics of Jewish belief is that we are in exile and we are forbidden to fight other nations. We are required to live in peace with our neighbors, not to harm or, God forbid, kill anyone. On the other side, we have the Zionist movement, which is the, generally speaking, the secular movement of Israel in general terms, who don't practice Judaism, don't believe in God. As I say, they simply don't believe in God. This was from the very beginning of Zionism to the present day. Masses of Jewish people, unfortunately, and they have nothing in their way to continue to support their national movement and their state of Israel, which they believe and they insist to call it, to call this a Jewish state. They would oppress other people, as unfortunately we see already for decades, kill and steal everything which is forbidden in Judaism. We need to be very clear and we need to understand a very simple concept. There is a great difference between Judaism and Zionism. Judaism is a religion, an ancient, old, thousands of year religion, and masses of Jewish people, basically the entire Jewish people that followed this religion for thousands of years. Then we have a relatively new movement, a national movement, which has nothing to do with religion, has nothing to do with godliness, a purely political movement, basically transforming Judaism from a religion into a nationalism. Should never be confused. In addition, my final point is that we have to understand, and masses of people in the world need to understand, that the state of Israel as a government, as a movement, in no way represents world Jewry. It's a group of people who are happen to be from Jewish descent, who don't follow anything of Judaism, and still in all, they do everything they can, and all crimes they commit, all violations of God's word and God's Torah, and unfortunately they still insist to represent all Jews. This is not the case, and should never be. They should never be considered as the representation of myself, my family, my communities, or the Jewish world at large.
The new data coming out of Israel on the tensions between secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox community gives clues of a crumbling society. The data shows that it is merely impossible for secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox community to coexist side by side. They believe that they are too different to live in the same neighborhood. The Israeli project meant to bring the two groups together to justify it as a home for all Jews. But it seems that not all Jews feel this way, as there are some fundamental issues that Israel can't seem to get rid of. For now, it seems that the crumbling apart of Israeli society continues, all the while politicians have immersed themselves in a fourth election after three failed ones in less than 2 years. Here are the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. A large majority of the Israeli public, 56%, believes that an incident similar to the storming of Capitol Hill by masses of protesters in Washington could take place in Israel. A poll conducted by Menachem Laser from Panels Politics for Ma'ariv, the Jerusalem Post's sister publication, found that 23% of respondents are sure that such an incident could take place in Israel as well. And another 33% guess that such an incident that shook the U.S. 2 days ago could happen as well. Ynet News. Riots erupted on the streets of two predominantly ultra-Orthodox communities after police broke up two massive illegal weddings just hours after Israel announced it was tightening its coronavirus lockdown. Police officers who arrived at the scene following reports of a mass event at first couldn't enter the event hall, which had a lock on the doors. Upon entering, the Rebbe was asked to disperse the event, but in response he offered police officers wine, who allowed the mass event to continue, with hundreds of attendees dancing and singing in a confined space with no social distancing or face masks. The Times of Israel. The Israeli Shin Bet Internal Spy Service hacked the phones of several anti-Netanyahu protesters on suspicion they sought to break into the Prime Minister's residence in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, Channel 13 News reported. The report said the agency was granted authorization to read messages on demonstrators' phones and search their homes after a number of protesters breached a police barricade outside the compound, with Netanyahu and his wife Sarah reportedly moved to a safe room. I-24 News. As Vice President Biden condemned building of 1,600 housing units in occupied eastern Jerusalem Al-Quds in 2010, Israel is expected to greenlight construction of new housing units in the eastern part of occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds before the swearing-in of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden on January 20. Public broadcaster CAN reported.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.